All right, so let's start where we sort of ended last time. So we introduced some concept of first order partial differential equations. We talked a lot about systems of hyperbolic first order equations and introduced a few sort of basic terminology. I'll just finish this up real quick now, and then we'll move on to discuss some more physics. In particular, we're going to discuss the Boltzmann equation and the Euler equations today. So let me just quickly finish up this sort of last part of chapter one. And so let me just draw this figure again, which we discussed at the very end of the last lecture. So say we look at the linear system in one spatial dimension, hyperbolic system, this form. And let's assume that these coefficients are constant, so that all the constant matrix. Then, you know, we were discussing that essentially the solution can be written as a superposition of weights these VI naught minus lambda IT times the ith eigenvector of the matrix A. And so these lambda I are again the eigenvalues of matrix A. And so we were essentially saying here that I was stressing this a lot, that essentially the solution is entirely determined by some initial data. And so we defined this set D of X and T, the domain of dependence, as all these initial points, as a subset of points of the domain of existence of the initial data, that entirely determines the solution at the spacetime point XT. So let's say we have a system of three equations. So M equals three here, and M equals three system with three eigenvalues. And let's say we call them lambda one. And let's say they have this order, which is essentially what I've drawn here. Then our domain of dependence would be exactly these three points here, x minus lambda 3t, x minus lambda 2t, and x minus lambda 1t. So this is our domain of dependence. And in fact, this can be, as Eric was noting last time, that can actually be a continuous interval in the nonlinear case. But actually the distinction between such a discrete set and a continuous set is not really important. And actually you see, if you look into definitions in sort of several different textbooks and papers, there's different authors make different definitions. And most often actually the domain of dependence is just defined as this entire interval essentially of the initial data that is subtended essentially by all the characteristics. So by essentially the maximum signal speeds. And there's another term that is sometimes used and that you will find in the literature a lot, which is the domain of determinancy. And that is essentially this entire cone of points where the solution is sort of entirely determined by this initial interval d0 down here. So let's call this entire interval down here d0, and all the points that are entirely determined by this set d0 is called this cone, this set of this domain of determinacy. Okay, this is where we left off last time. And so I just wanted to make one last definition, which is just sort of reversing this into the opposite direction and say, let's say we're at some point R0 in Rn, and then we can also define the range of influence. And I just call this D plus. So in analogy, this is sometimes denoted by D minus. D plus in our sort of space-time, if you want. And this is the set of points xt in which the solution ux of t is actually influenced by this data at x naught. So which the solution ux of t is influenced by initial data at this point x naught . So in the obvious sketch, the obvious figure to draw here is following. So again, x and t here, and let's choose some point x naught here. And then again, let's look at the same m equals 3 system as above. And then essentially to get the domain of influence, we just follow the characteristics through x naught. So this is our range of influence. So this would be lambda 1t. Okay. And so I just wanted to sort of, in a sort of abstract way here, just introduce these this terminology. We'll get back to this when we talk about the CFL conditions and when we sort of design numerical stencils to numerically solve these hyperbolic systems. And then we'll have to make sure that essentially the numerical, so-called numerical domain of dependence includes the sort of physical or the sort of mathematical domain of dependence of the actual corresponding analytic equations. And so that will essentially lead us to the so-called CFL conditions that some of you will have encountered already. Okay.
Daniel, I have a question.
Yes, sure.
So imagine we have a point to the right of x naught. So I can see that if I draw the characteristics going outside that point, I'm going to have crossing between the ones that go to the left and right. So is this telling me the information in X naught is not going to be the only thing that determines the solution at, say, this crossing, but also the information at X naught plus something?
Yes, exactly. So this is exactly what we've just plotted essentially above, right? So if you look up here, the solution at this point here is essentially determined by these three other points. right? So that's exactly what it's saying. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Okay, any other questions?
Daniel, I have a silly question.
Yes, of course.
It was kind of motivated by what Eric had to say last time about why don't we solve these equations using by transforming them into these characteristic equations. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's mainly because A is not equal to constant and it changes from point to point.
That's right.
But then when you numerically discretize, you take some limit anyways, right? So why can't we take a small, step in time and assume that A is constant there and then propagate the solution, recompute things, and then go on that way? Like,
yeah,
which that's part of this fails is what I'm wondering.
Like, yeah, that's a really good question. And so there are actually methods where you can go about this and you can try to numerically construct your solution. So say you're sitting at a space-time point X and you want to construct the solution around it. You can actually use a method based on characteristics, and sort of locally in a finite region that may work. The problem that you get with nonlinear systems is that you can only expect smooth solutions to locally exist. So what we'll see is that the nonlinear equations give rise to very interesting phenomena, nonlinear phenomena that we call shocks and other things, where the solution becomes discontinuous. So not even differentiable, but even discontinuous. And that is exactly where your method with the method sort of with characteristics will fail, because you assume that everything is smooth. You assume that the characteristics, so gamma can be, is differentiable. So you can actually get the characteristic speeds and that they are well-defined, so gamma prime. But that breaks actually down. And you can show that's a fundamental sort of property of these nonlinear equations, that sort of local existence of smooth solutions. So that only exists locally and not globally. So if you want to really construct your solution globally, you'll have to resort to other methods in general. And that's where sort of the complications come in. And so we'll discuss this in a lot more detail in the future.
Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for the question. Really good question. Okay, if there are no more questions, then let's move on to discuss some physics for a change. And so what I wanted to start with here is just in the second chapter, just to discuss essentially the basic equations of sort of that we deal with in computational fluid dynamics and sort of where they come from, what the sort of basis is, and also point out a few properties. And later on, we'll discuss the Euler equations or sort of more generally conservation laws and their mathematical properties in more detail, but that will be sort of later on. Now let's just motivate essentially the case for conservation laws. And so we'll see that the basic equations that we're going to deal with in computational fluid dynamics are essentially conservation laws. And even if we're not dealing intrinsically with conservation laws, there are always sort of approximations to reality that we can do, that we can make, and we can actually sometimes transform sort of non-conservation laws into conservation laws. So essentially the punchline of this chapter will be that we're really interested in conservation laws, and so this is where we have to develop our numerical methods around. Okay, and so I wanted to start discussing this continuous medium approximation. So that leads us to the Boltzmann equation. So, I mean, the system that we are essentially, the model system essentially that we're thinking of a lot in astrophysics and cosmology, but also in many other fields in physics and engineering as a fluid. And so in principle, we can think of this as individual sort of particles. It can be gas particles or sort of fluid elements. And let's say we look at these individual particles in phase space. So let's assume essentially we know their position and momenta or velocities, ui. Then if we look at such a fluid as sort of an n particle system, then we have essentially a six-dimensional phase space. So three velocity components, three conjugate momentum components. And so what I've just drawn here is just essentially the projection onto the ith coordinate plane in this sort of 6D space. So the xi ui plane. And sort of let's focus here on sort of a control volume that has some finite or say infinitesimal sort of extension in velocity and in space dxi. And so we think of this here just as some gas or liquid particles, so atoms or sometimes molecules. And so in principle, if we look at this system, the evolution of this system is essentially entirely determined by Newtonian mechanics. And that's a so-called n-body approach. So in principle, we can, if we know the position and momenta of these particles, we can exactly predict how the system is going to evolve. And so everyone knows Newton's equations. So that's the sort of, would be the sort of n body approach. Just write down dxi by dt is the velocity, and then the acceleration is given by the force fi onto the ith particle. So this is x j uj comma t for all particles. And so this is force on particle I. And so we have here I and J both labeled particles, not spacetime or not spatial dimensions. So maybe I should actually use a different letter up here. K or so, just not to make things too confusing. Right, and now these equations look somewhat, you know, deceptively simple. Everyone knows Newton's equations, but there are essentially two problems with that. So one is obviously these equations may be highly non-trivial if depending on the force on the right-hand side, and there can be a rich sort of nonlinear dynamics that these equations can give rise to, and they can be very complicated to deal with computationally. So usually what is done, so this n-body approach is in particular suitable also in astrophysics and cosmology for systems that are collisionless. So where you can actually, you know, describe these particles, or you can think of like individual galaxies, for example, or you think of those as individual stars in a stellar cluster or in a nuclear star cluster at the center of a galaxy. And this is where usually these n-body techniques are used. And sort of even there, if you just include gravity, the non-linearity of these equations can become very tricky. And so you have to use a lot of numerical tricks to actually get an accurate result of the evolution of the system. So you have to regularize these equations, for example, if particles come too close to each other and so on and so forth. And you have to have very accurate numerical integration techniques to sort of make the error, the numerical error of the evolution of the system not grow too fast. And the second problem is, in particular, if we deal with sort of fluids where we are in the collision regime, where there's lots of interactions between individual particles, such as in an actual gas and plasma, there we have the following obviously computational problem that essentially if we just look at one mole of this of such particles, so we just take a tiny bit gas. Essentially, so you know Avogadro's constant is something like 6 × 10⁻³ particles. And so if you want to sort of evolve each individual particle according to these equations, that becomes computationally prohibitive. And so if we want to study gas and plasma flow, we have to resort to some sort of statistical approach where we average over an ensemble of these individual particles and where we sort of give up the individual particle description. But nonetheless, as I mentioned, n-body techniques are everywhere in astrophysics, especially nowadays if you follow some of the LIGO announcements and sort of all the discussion that is going on about the formation channels for these heavy binary black hole systems, sort of where stellar evolution calculations are being done in globular clusters and nuclear star clusters and so on. So this is exactly where there's a lot of these n-body techniques at play these days. So they are really everywhere in astrophysics for sort of collisionless systems. And even the Millennium simulation that I showed you in the first lecture last week, that was also actually an n-body code that produced those large-scale cosmological simulations back in the early 2000s. Nonetheless, yeah.
You remember on the top of your head how many particles can be included in those state-of-the-art codes?
Oh, that is a good question. Actually, I don't know off the top of my head. So essentially, the tricks that are done are so I'm not an expert on n-body techniques, but so essentially the tricks that are done are so that you essentially don't include all the particles, so you don't sum over all particles when you sort of when you focus on one particle and you want to evolve that to the next time step, you don't just sum over all particles, but you sort of make clever use of some approximation techniques where you can sort of approximate a far field sort of influence of other particles in a sort of more simplified manner, and that allows you to scale up to many more particles than you would be able to do just by following everything really individually. And so there's lots of tricks done in this regard. And so that depends on then on how you actually compute this right-hand side, this force on the right-hand side. And that essentially then determines, given some sort of computational capability you have, that determines then how many particles you can afford. I'm not actually entirely sure what the number is, and I would have to guess now, and I probably shouldn't do it because it may likely be wrong. But it's a huge amount of particles.
And you're being recorded, so you don't want to.
And I'm being recorded, and
okay, that, thank you. Right.
But I can dig out some numbers for you, sure. Okay, so let's look at this in some sort of statistical manner. And the way that we can do this is just by saying, well, if we look at this control volume, right, we can just say the number of particles here is just given by some density, but by some distribution function that tells us how many particles we have per control volume in this control volume dx by du in phase space. So this is what we call the distribution function. And this is the number of particles in the control volume dx du. Okay. So now we can also assume that in general, there will be some external force that will be applied to these particles in this control volume. So let's say, let's assume that particles are subject to external force. And here I just choose that force to be formulated as a force per unit mass. So a specific force, if you want, let's call it F. And obviously for this sort of statistical approach to be valid, that force has to be roughly constant over the volume, over the typical volume or the sort of typical particle separation, interparticle separation, but also over the control volume that we're looking at. So constant over typical interparticle separation. And so if we follow then, say such a control volume of particles in phase space, then the number of these particles should be conserved along sort of their trajectories as we follow their trajectories. So particle number f of x, u, and t, dx, du. Is conserved along their trajectories. And this is actually, some of you may recognize this as a Liouville's theorem. So this can sort of be proved more rigorously in phase space. Unless there are obviously interactions, so scatterings or sort of some sinks, particles are created or destroyed. But if that is not the case, we should get the following expression, namely that if we look, if we follow the stream of such particles in phase space, over a time delta t. So we go move along the particle trajectory from x to x plus sort of u times delta t. Then their momenta have changed according to Newton's equation, according to this external force that is applied to those particles. So u goes to u plus f times delta t. And we go from time t to t plus delta t. So we're just following this trajectory of fluid particles. And so that should be conserved, meaning that the difference between this and the original point should be zero. Let's call this delta f. Also point, denote this with a star because I'll refer to this later on. Now, if we actually have collisions, then this may be non-zero. So particles may be scattered out of that sort of element in control volume in phase space. And so this is why we can also introduce a term on the right-hand side, the so-called collision term. So this captures the change in F during the time step delta t due to collisions. And now from this relation, we can obviously take the limit of this time step delta t going to zero, which means that delta f essentially approaches the total derivative of df by dt. And so we'll get the following equation, famous equation, which is known as Boltzmann's transport equation, partial derivative of f with respect to time, plus the derivatives of the other entries, fi df by dui. And then on the right-hand side, we have this collision term that controls the way that particles are sort of kicked in and out of a volume in phase space. So that's the famous Boltzmann equation. That some of you may know. Okay, and so this describes now the evolution of our distribution function f in the six-dimensional phase space. So this captures in the statistical approach the entire evolution of the system that we're interested in. In 6D phase space. Now, let's make some additional definitions that will be actually useful. Again, I should point out that still we have the problem. So this equation now is sort of a statistical approach, and sort of we have already reduced the complexity somewhat so that we don't need to describe individual particles. We can describe ensembles of particles. But still, we have the problem that this is an equation in 6D phase space, six-dimensional function. And so if we want to sort of evolve this computationally, we have a six-dimensional space. And so these are a lot of grid points to cover. And so again, you will find that even for very, very simple problems, this will become computationally prohibitive, at least if you don't make any additional assumptions, like introduce some spatial symmetries or things like that, that reduce the complexity of the problem and reduce the dimensionality of the problem. So for example, there's lots of applications and direct evolution, sort of direct simulations of Boltzmann's transport equation in one spatial dimension. So where you only then have essentially like a four-dimensional space. But if you go to a full 3D, you have a six-dimensional space, and that is computationally very costly. As I said, even for very simple toy problems, it's computationally prohibitive still with given computational resources. So how can we actually get to something that is even simpler than that and is actually computationally feasible? And that is exactly what will bring us to the Euler equations. But before actually doing that, I need to introduce sort of a few definitions here. So a few things we can compute with the six-dimensional distribution function are the following. So we can essentially marginalize or sort of integrate over the momentum part of our phase space to get the total number of particles in the spatial control volume. So note we are here only integrating over the velocity part of the phase space, and that gives us the total number of particles, so particles per unit volume So this in here, just to be precise, is in this interval u plus u and then u plus du. And the entire expression is the total number of particles per unit volume. Okay, and so that immediately allows us to introduce a length scale. Namely, we can just define the cubic root of this number density as the mean particle separation, just as a characteristic length scale of the system. And this means already that any physical length scale that we are interested in, say dx, must be much larger, obviously, than this length, this interparticle, typical interparticle separation length scale, for this statistical approach to be sort of reasonable and meaningful. And this is why, for example, this breaks down in the collisionless regime. And this is why then, you know, you would resort more to sort of n-body particle simulations. Now, the next definition is sort of the bulk, the mean density, which we can get by just multiplying the particle number with the mass of an individual particle. So this is mass of particle. So this is the bulk mass density. And then we can define in a similar way the bulk velocity of the flow, again by integrating out over the velocity part of phase space. So this is the bulk velocity. And then we can also define the specific internal energy, rho epsilon of x comma t, which just tracks essentially the kinetic energy of the individual particle motion. So the peculiar velocity of each individual sort of gas particle. So this will be 1/2 integral m and then u tilde, which is u tilde squared, which is the peculiar velocity. I'll just write this down in a second. So this is the specific internal energy epsilon. And so u tilde, this vector u tilde, just defined as u minus v. So the individual, the difference between the individual particle velocity and the bulk velocity of the flow. Okay. And just as a final quick remark to these definitions, a special case of this Boltzmann equation up here is that if we have elastic collisions, so this collision term on the right-hand side respects energy and momentum conservation. So energy momentum conserved. And momentum is conserved, then, and also we take the low density limit so that multi-body interactions, multi-particle interactions can be neglected. So so three and four body interactions in particular, then one can show also if we're neglecting external forces, so F is identical to zero, then one can show, and you may know recall this from statistical mechanics, there's a unique solution to the Boltzmann equation up there. And that is the famous Maxwellian velocity distribution. So X, U and T, so this distribution function is N, so this particle number density that we just defined, 2 pi kb. And then there's a temperature down here that I didn't introduce, but can be defined through the specific internal energy, epsilon. So I won't go into a lot more detail because it will not be important for what we actually want to do. But I just wanted to make this note here so you can directly obtain the Maxwellian velocity distribution from this approach. 2 kb t of x comma t. U. Okay. Any questions so far?
I guess I have a question about the that result of getting the Maxwell distribution. So because you're letting t depend on x and t, you're not saying that the system is in equilibrium. So I guess what you're saying is that there exists a function t of x and t such that a solution to Boltzmann's equation can be put in that form. Is that?
Yes.
That the gist of it?
Yes. So so the assumption of thermodynamic equilibrium would be even stronger. So here the conditions are a little bit relaxed, and that is apparently possible. Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. So I on the reading list, I will point out a few things where you can actually read up a little bit more on this sort of on this statistical mechanics approach. Sort of if you want to dive into this in a little more detail. Any other questions? Okay, if not, then... Oh,
sorry.
Yeah, follow up.
Sorry to interrupt. as a follow-up, so is so does T satisfy some equation, or is it a completely freely choosable function?
No, it is specified in terms of it is not freely choosable, so it is specified in terms of the specific internal energy. So it is sort of it'll result from there's some relation here to this quantity here.
Okay, and that
so it is related to the
That would look a little bit like an equation of state then.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, it actually needs to satisfy something that looks like the equation of state for an ideal gas.
Right. Okay. Don't know if I came across this result before. It's certainly very nice.
Yeah. There's. I can point you to a book that actually covers this quite quite intensively, but I don't recall all the details, to be honest.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Thank you.
Yep, you're welcome. Okay, any other questions? Okay, if not, then now let's make use of these definitions that we've just made, and let's try to think of some approximation to the Boltzmann equation that is easier to handle. And that brings me to the definition of moments of the Boltzmann equation. And this will be exactly the sort of conceptual trick that we will be using, and that will lead us to the Euler equations, because what I'm going to derive here is that the Euler equations are essentially just moment approximations to the Boltzmann equation. So let's define the kth moment of the Boltzmann equation by just taking the equation, multiplying it by some power of the velocity, and then integrating over velocity. So uk is just defined as some power of the velocity vector. So in particular, we're going to look at u0, which is 1, u1, which is u, and we'll also look at the second moment of the Boltzmann equation, which is u squared. And then accordingly, on the right-hand side, we have uk, and then our collision term. Bu. And now, without even sort of going in more detail and going sort of more deeper on the statistical mechanics level, there's already some properties, some general properties that this collision term, so this right-hand side integral, actually needs to satisfy. So let me just write this down. Let's look at general properties of this collision term. So if collisions are elastic, again, this will be sort of the domain that we'll be interested in. And by elastic, again, we mean that they conserve the energy and momentum. And let's say also that we don't have any processes that either create or destroy particles. However, this actually may arise in, you know, in many systems, because, you know, photons can be created by pair creation or so, or particles can also be destroyed. So we'll talk about these kind of things later on. So this is something that we'll sort of include as source terms. But for now, let's focus on this case where we just think of collisions and elastic collisions. Then this right-hand side integral has to follow the following properties. So this is the number of particles is conserved. Right, so this is essentially just an integral statement of the Boltzmann equation above. So let me just scroll up here. So essentially, if we just look at this expression here, and sorry to include this part here as well, and sort of we turn this into an integral statement, then we immediately get that for the total number of particles, so for f at some point displaced by dx along the particle trajectory, and the original f has to vanish, so the integral has to vanish. Now, we can do this just by multiplying with the velocity, which corresponds to the total momentum conservation. So strictly speaking, this follows from the from Liouville's theorem. And then also the total energy is conserved. And also, if we integrate over this sort of velocity space, or this part of the phase space, as the velocity goes to infinity, all these quantities have to stay finite. So any combination of velocity times any power of the velocity times the distribution function has to vanish as we go to infinite velocities. So in other words, the distribution function has to sort of fall off rapidly. Okay, so with these properties, we can compute some terms here on the left-hand side. So let's see what we find. So we can compute the integral partial f with respect to velocity, something like a zero moment of this. And so by partial integration, you can convince yourself that the only term that, or let me just write it out in more detail. So we have to integrate the distribution function over some surface at infinity, and then subtract this other term, which is essentially just factor one here in front. And this derivative is obviously zero, f du. And so this integral is zero. Now we can compute the same thing, but just multiplied by some velocity component uj. Again, we can do partial integration, and I won't do the details here. I mean, you can work it out yourself. What you'll find is that there's just some delta ij rho m. Again, the term that is sort of the integration over at sort of infinity vanishes because f falls off rapidly. So, we have made this assumption here. Falls off sufficiently rapidly, so this boundary term vanishes, and then the other term will just give this delta ij component of the essentially of the number density, or here expressed in terms of the actual mass density divided by the individual particle's mass. Okay, and then finally, let's look at u squared partial f. Then again, with partial integration. Okay, let me actually write this out. Again, here, this is the surface term that vanishes. So this is zero. And then we have this second term. All right, and then this is simply UIF, which is pulling in the definitions from above, the number density times the ith component of the bulk velocity field. of the fluid. So these are some sort of useful expressions that immediately follow from basic definitions. And so we'll now be using those. And so the idea now is, as I mentioned, let's look at a moment expansion of the Boltzmann equation and see what we get at every order. So let's compute the zero moment of the Boltzmann equation. So, and I already multiplied here with the particle mass m, just to get it into the right form. So this is the first term. This is our second term of the Boltzmann equation, integrated over velocity space. And now we have the third term, this external force term. And we've just shown that this integral is actually zero. So this was our first identity up here. And then on the right-hand side, we have the collision term. Vu. And so this is equivalent to the following form. I'm just pulling out the derivative here. And I will do the same thing here because the position and conjugate momenta are independent variables. So I can just pull out that derivative. And so what I'll get is the following. And so you'll notice that this is actually a very familiar equation. So if we plug in the definitions from above, just using definitions, we get actually partial derivative of rho with respect to time plus the divergence of rho times the bulk velocity v equals zero. And this, some of you at least will know, is the continuity equation of hydrodynamics. So this directly follows from the zero moment of the Boltzmann equation. Also, just a quick note on this equation. Some of you may know. This just expresses mass conservation, so the conservation of total mass of a system, which you'll see immediately here is obtained in a very simple way. So let's just integrate over a large volume, ideally, you know, the volume that contains the whole system. And then we can use Gauss's theorem and get rid of this divergence term. So with sort of Gauss theorem, we can re-express this as a surface integral over the surface of the volume. And now at the boundary, obviously, we go far enough, at some point there is no fluid anymore, no fluid velocity, so this just vanishes. So we're just left with this integral. Which is just expressing that the total mass is conserved. Okay, so this probably looks familiar to some of you. Any questions so far?
I have a question about the notation. What exactly is uk? Because u is a vector, right? And you're raising it to the power. I mean, it makes sense when you write the moments. At once, it looks like energy, but then it's a vector at times.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I have to apologize. So the notation may not be very consistent, and you're right in pointing that out. In some cases, these indices are components of vectors. In other cases, it's actually powers of u. I should probably think about fixing that in a better way. So this here is actually the sort of exponent that's not the component of a vector. So in the definition here, this uk here is not a component of a vector. It's just labeled. So k is just labeling the power that we're looking at. So it's essentially just labeling the moment we're looking at, 0, 1, or 2 in this case. We actually won't go higher than that. Does that clarify your question?
Yeah, so no, I mean, I understand for 0, 1, and 2, but then the thing is U2, is it a number or is it still like a vector? Whereas U1 is a vector, right? Because I'm looking at the hat there.
And yes.
U2, right. is it the norm of the vector to the x power 2, like in some sense?
Yes, exactly. So this is just the norm of this vector.
Okay, great. Okay, sounds good.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay. If not, then let's go on and let's look at the first moment of the Boltzmann equation. And so here we'll get the. Okay. So first moment. So again, I already multiply the Boltzmann equation by the particle mass m. So now all the terms carry an additional velocity component in front. So now we have ui, uj, du. Plus m, and so this is our external force term. And so, as you may remember from above, if I scroll up here, now we're making use of this identity here. So this is just minus Kronecker delta ij rho over m. And on the right-hand side, we have the collision term. And we've also shown that one general property of, so the momentum conservation, total conservation of momentum required this term to be zero. So this has to vanish. Now, again, plugging in definitions from above, we have rho vi plus partial derivative this term here minus rho fi equals zero. And now we need to massage the second term a little bit to make it look or turn it into something that is more familiar. So let's take a closer look at this second term. this UI UJ term. Now, if we again introduce the peculiar velocities, we just re-express the individual particle velocity as its peculiar velocity plus the bulk flow velocity, VI. Then get a few terms here, VI, VJ, just following the algebra, UI tilde, UJ tilde, F, DU. And so if we define this, so the first term you'll see immediately is just the, sort of this integral part is just the rest mass density, so the density of the fluid, of the bulk flow, times VI, VJ. And then we just call this right hand side, so this the second term, we just call this the pressure tensor, PIJ. And so essentially for most cases that we are interested in, we'll make the assumption that we're dealing with a so-called isotropic pressure, so that only the diagonal elements of this pressure tensor are non-zero. So in most cases, and in particular in lots of astrophysical applications, that's a perfectly valid assumption. We just deal with isotropic pressure. So Pij, we'll just make this ansatz, Pij equals some function P times Kronecker delta ij. And so from the definitions above, you'll notice that we can write this actually as 1/3 times the integral of m u tilde squared f du. And if you compare this to an even earlier definition, you'll see that there's a relation of p equals 2/3 rho epsilon. Okay, anyways, we just make this ansatz, and then the equations sort of further simplify. We'll talk about anisotropies and anisotropic pressure or shear tensor sort of in the next section when we deal with the Navier-Stokes equation. For now, we'll just assume isotropic pressure, and then the equations simplify, and we have, plugging this in into the equation above, just have the simple pressure term here, just the gradient of this isotropic pressure. And so you'll notice that this is just the momentum equation, part of the Euler equations. So just written in vector notation, you can write this as the divergence of a momentum flux tensor pi. And then we have the external source on the right hand side. So here I've just defined this momentum flux tensor rho vi vj plus p delta ij. And that's the momentum flux tensor. Okay, so this is another equation that may look familiar to some of you. Yes?
Daniel, what happened to the cross terms?
Which cross terms?
Right, as you were deriving the pressure tensor, the U dot V terms.
Oh yeah, those vanish. You can convince yourself with so the peculiar velocities are, you know, they are random motions. So if you integrate over over just one component, u I tilde or so, you would expect that to vanish sort of to first order. So that's how the cross terms essentially cancel. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Good question. Thank you. So, okay, that is another equation that may look familiar to you. And now finally, in the sort of last bit of this lecture, let's look at the second moment. Of the Boltzmann equation. So here I won't follow all the steps in great detail. That's actually more of an exercise for you, and I'll put this on the exercise on the first problem set. You know, following the same recipes as above, one can show that from the second moment, you'll get the following equation. And then on the right-hand side, there is an expression that we call the heat flux. Oh, apologize, I need to start a new line. Plus rho VI FI. And so here we have defined this vector HI as the following expression. So this is actually something like a third moment here, where we have the power of three in terms of velocity. And this is essentially called the heat flux. And we'll actually neglect this here. I'll get back to this in a little while, but for now I'll just note that this term can be neglected for many astrophysical, for most astrophysical applications. So this describes essentially a microscopic heat flux from one tiny fluid element to the next, and that gives rise to these shear terms. I'll discuss this a little bit in a little more detail when we talk about the Navier-Stokes equations, which is exactly when this term again comes in. So neglecting this for now, we can write this equation in the following form: E plus P VI, where capital E is the total energy, just write this down. So this is the total energy equation. Where capital E is defined as 1/2 rho V squared, which is the kinetic energy of the bulk flow, plus rho epsilon, which is the thermal or internal energy part of the fluid. Okay, for now we won't go actually higher than that. And so I'll just point out a few things here. So these three equations that we derived, 1, 2, and 3, from the zero, first, and second order moment of the Boltzmann equation are known as the Euler equations. And the important thing for us, important conclusion for us, is that they can actually be rewritten as a system of strictly hyperbolic conservation laws. And in fact, I will only show here that they can be written as a system of conservation laws. And on the first problem set, using a method that we just introduced in the first chapter, you will actually show that this is a strictly hyperbolic system under reasonable conditions for the sound speed. So it depends on the sound speed. If you go into the limit of zero sound speed, essentially, then that strict hyperbolicity breaks down, and that's actually a problem. Also for codes, for example, if your sound speed sort of approaches zero. But other than that, they are strictly hyperbolic. So we can actually write them in this form, or sort of if you like the sort of more standard notation, where as usual here, we have a sum over this index I. And let me just write down what the fluxes, what the conserved variables and the fluxes are. So U is this vector of conserved variables, rho times bulk velocity, and then total energy E. These are our conserved variables. And then the fluxes are given by this expression, rho VI. So actually, so we're only dealing here with three vectors, so it doesn't matter where actually I put these indices up or down. And so VI, and you can just read them off essentially, comparing to these previous expressions here. So there's no, I've already written down the Euler equations in such a form that you can essentially just read off the conservation law nature of the equations. So J equals 1, 2, and 3. So these are the momentum components. And I labels the flux directions, just to be very explicit. And so this is what usually people just refer to as the fluxes. And then finally, we have the source terms on the right-hand side, which are given by this external force field F. And that can be gravity or something else, some other long range force. Now, I should also point out that as written down now, the system is not yet closed. So we have actually an equation. We have actually five equations for six unknowns. And that brings me to discuss the equation of state. And this is not surprising because we were just following we're just approximating, we just have an incomplete approximation essentially to the Boltzmann equation. We just took the first three moments and we're discarding all the rest. And so it's obvious that something is missing. So what we have so far is our five equations for six unknowns. So we have, in particular, we have the density rho. We have the three components of the bulk velocity V. And then we have pressure. And we have internal energy E, or rho epsilon. So this was this quantity that called rho epsilon. So what we do, what we actually require is a relation that connects pressure, this isotropic pressure, to density and internal energy to close the system. And this is exactly what we call the equation of state. And so this has to be specified somehow by sort of different formalism, different approach that tries to capture sort of some of the microphysics of the system that we are ignoring by just taking this moment approach and writing down the Euler equations. So for example, for an ideal gas, this expression would be gamma minus one times E, or gamma minus one rho epsilon, where gamma is the ratio of the specific heats of the gas. So this is specific heats, also known as the adiabatic constant. But in general, this can be sort of almost arbitrarily complicated and complex if we sort of depart from ideal gases. So in general, P is some function of the density of the internal energy of the composition. So we may have sort of more than just one particle type. We may have multi-component gases. We may have multi-component fluids. We may have, or different nuclei if we're thinking of sort of a plasma in which we just have individual nucleons, which is the case, for example, if we simulate neutron stars, so something that that I like to do. So there can be all sorts of additional variables here. So this, in general, can be very complex. So there can be different chemical elements. So this is, for example, something if you simulate sort of interstellar clouds or star forming regions and things like that, you have to take into account ionization states of gas. So H1 clouds, H2 clouds. So you have to actually account for chemical reactions and have to, and then depending on the ionization states of the molecules you have, you get different pressure for a given density and internal energy and so on and so forth. So all sorts of complicated physics, so-called microphysics, would actually go into this equation of state and be captured in there. Essentially everything that we ignored, and that should be essentially in the Boltzmann equation without going through this moment approach. Okay, so this, because different elements, chemical elements, ionization states, or even, you know, very complicated chemical reactions that could be going on there. Complicated chemical reactions, etc. Okay, any questions so far? Time is also up. I think this is a good time to stop anyways. Any final questions or thoughts or comments? Okay, so the plan essentially will be that this more or less essentially concludes the discussion of the Euler equations, at least for now. So next time we'll start to discuss, to relax some of these assumptions and discuss about sort of viscous fluids. So this will bring us to the Navier-Stokes equations. And we'll also talk about magnetohydrodynamics next time. So these will be the two topics for Tuesday. And then afterwards, on probably on Thursday next week, then we'll discuss radiation transport, and then finally also the relativistic sort of the sort of relativistic versions of the Euler equations and radiation transport in both in special and in general relativity. And we'll see that essentially in all these cases, we'll end up with conservation laws where we can use numerical methods for sort of in flat space for systems of hyperbolic PDEs to solve essentially all these problems. Okay, if there are no further questions, then...
Daniel, I have a related but unrelated question that also might sound stupid. So if you were to do one of these n-body Newtonian simulations, at what point should you start worrying about causality and the fact that you're using Newtonian physics and you're considering like very big scenarios, like, I don't know, like large scale structure and stuff like that? Because like the forces that you would be using in the case, imagine you have this gigantic computer and you can actually say, oh, the force that is influencing this particle here from the particle that it's like so many light years away is this F, but we know that that shouldn't be the case, right?
Yes, that's right.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there are a few things. So if you're interested in sort of large scale phenomena like cosmological problems, then typically when people think about problems that involve like structure formation, and this is like, you know, the type of systems you would be looking at, so large scale structure of the universe. So these are actually all Newtonian simulations, and sort of you completely ignore the effects of GR here. Then, so these are sort of these were the early type sort of cosmological simulations. Now, there are actually approaches to take into account at least approximately some GR effects into n-body simulations, and this is essentially in compact systems, where we discuss, where people investigate like the dynamics of nuclear star clusters or globular clusters. And there, relativistic effects become important because if sort of stars come close to each other, compact objects, like, you know, typically you deal with black holes because these are the only objects that remain in these clusters. Everything else is lighter and is going to be kicked out during the core collapse of such a cluster. And if then you get into the near field dynamics of compact objects, where we actually need GR to accurately evolve the orbits of these particles, and this is where people actually put in or try to put in post-Newtonian terms into these n-body codes. So your force on the right hand side will not just be the Newtonian gravity force, but they actually include some sort of post-Newtonian terms, and actually get fairly accurate evolution, at least for some dynamic interactions in there. And so this is mainly where people try to include GR into, or at least in some approximate way, into these n-body simulations. But this is essentially the state of the art there.
Okay. No, I was like more wondering about like the things are very far away. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem correct to say that the force, because you're basically working on a slice, right? So you say that the force that a particle feels here is the force that is imprinted by a particle. It's very, very far away.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make sense to me. At
least. Oh, yeah, sure. So you're worrying about causality and things like that. Yeah, sorry. Okay, I understand what you mean. Yeah, yeah. That's in fact ignored, yes.
Oh, okay.
I mean, to some extent, it depends. It always depends on how you would define these long-range forces, because as I mentioned earlier, it's actually impossible, sort of, if you want to do an actual n-body simulation, it's very hard to do if you really want to follow the effect of every individual particle. So typically what you do is try to sort of approximate the far field by some approach. And so this is then also where these problems of causality come in. I'm not entirely sure how they deal with this, but I suspect that actually these problems are ignored.
Okay, there maybe it's negligible, like it doesn't really matter because maybe velocities are not very high or something, so you can like, expect everything to be more or less the same. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Any other final thoughts?
I do actually have another question.
Yeah.
So you have now shown, so to say, the statistical approach on how to approximate the exact microscopic equation of the system, so to say. I was wondering if things like renormalization group techniques are also applied to such systems to kind of get an approximate large-scale description of the behavior of the system, similar to what is done with the Ising model in solid-state physics.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I'm not an expert on this kinetic gas theory. I suspect that such techniques would be used there. And in fact, if we sort of relax you know, some of the hydrodynamic assumptions that we think are valid for most cases in astrophysics and, you know, many other fields, then you have to resort to kinetic gas theory. And so you have to sort of go back to a more sort of particle-based description of things. That's also, in particular, this is the case for some fusion reactors or so when you deal with like plasmas in the collisionless regime. So I'm not exactly aware of how they are applied there, but I presume that people are thinking about this in those contexts. But yeah, I have to admit, I'm not an expert on kinetic gas theory, so